down here. Have you watched those little news reporters? They're just about to wet all over themselves. They've got another storm out there, gang, and they can hardly contain themselves. Jeez, I have never seen anything like this. This is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon, and you are about to take a walk to the other side. Please, I need to take a walk to the other side. Relieve me of the insanity that's going on and on our planet right now. My goodness sakes. The Democrats are upset because there's going to be a new show on television that's going to bust Bill Clinton wide open. The Republicans are upset because the Democrats are busting Rumsfeld and Bush again. So what else is new? I can tell you that my relatives in Haifa are very relieved to not have the missiles flying overhead. I got another email today, and she said that things are finally peaceful, and they are feeling very, very relieved for the time being. There's the operative. So we have lots going on in the world, and if we're not careful, we can all get on overload and feel like there's no place to hide except for under our covers in our bed. So turn off that damn TV, put the newspaper down, and get yourself an ice-cold drink, and let's get our spiritual groove on here a little bit. I think that we're beginning to lose our sense of spirituality. Anytime there is conflict in the world, we've had a lot of that lately, and anytime the power addicts decide this is the time to get all upset and see if they can amass more power on both sides of the aisle, thank you very much. What happens for poor schmoes like you and me is that we have a tendency to get real caught up in it, and we get very overwhelmed, and we forget that we have a choice. We have a choice about how much of this we can get into. I was sitting with some friends today, and Al Jazeera put out one more tape. Here we go. September 11th is right around the corner. So, well, hello, these idiots, of course they're going to put a tape out. That's what they do best. They terrorize. It's part of terrorization. And this one old gal, she told me that, well, I'm not going anywhere, I'm not traveling anywhere, I'm not doing anything, I've had it. And I informed her that I was probably going to be going to Israel in the winter, and she looked at me as if I had lost my mind. So be careful of the drive-by media. Let's have some fun, you guys. Let's take a look at what's going on in the paranormal news. There's some really interesting stuff happening out there, and that's usually what happens when you have major conflict. What happens is everybody gets so tuned in to Debbie Dunst standing out there screaming and yelling about the latest tropical depression or the airing of an Al Jazeera terrorist clip over and over again that people kind of miss some of the stuff that's happening. And September 4th, just this week, the Daily Mail came out with something that I thought was just, here we go again, here we go again. Our brains are hardwired to believe supernatural, say doctors. So, here we go again, age-old debate. Are we wired to believe in the paranormal? Do those paranormal experiences that you and me and so many others have, is that just a part of our genetic makeup? Well, according to this latest bit of, I'm not going to curse, but bad research, children become attached to comfort blankets and specific toys because of a Harry Potter effect, an inbuilt belief in magic and spirituality, scientists said today. Researchers claim belief in magic is hardwired into the brain from birth. Well, my dog isn't out there worrying about magic, and my cat isn't worrying about magic. Now, there is magical thinking that happens with children, which is a whole different ball game. Magical beliefs help us connect with those we love or hate, said Professor Bruce Hood of the University of Bristol, who led the research. In babies, we believe this effect is strong, but in many adults, it is as well. a lot of people believe in the supernatural. That has exactly the same effect. Now, right away, I'm going to pick this apart because I got an email this week from somebody who is a bona fide atheist, a physician and an atheist, and they had an empathetic deathbed experience with a patient. They actually felt their patient, in this woman's words, going home. And she was so stunned, this physician, and she was so taken aback. She was not a religious person, so, you know, I guess they're saying she's hardwired too. He said attachment to objects is part of the same type of behavior. The brains of even young babies not only organize sensory information, but supply what is missing and generate theories about the world. This comes straight out of family systems theory. If I'm a little kid and I'm living in a nutsy family, and mom is drunk and dad is drunk and there's all kinds of chaos going on in the family, what I'm going to do as a little kid is I'm going to naturally make their behavior about me, because children are naturally self-centered and narcissistic. And if they don't have adults there to say to them, whoa, you know, mom's drunk, dad's drunk, see the booze they put in their bodies, see how weird they behave afterwards, that has nothing to do with you. Yes, children will use magical thinking to make sense of their environment because it gives them a false sense of control. So this person has taken the whole concept of magical thinking in children, which Alice Miller, great author, great book, Drama of the Gifted Child, wrote about eons ago, and has now applied it to those of us who have had paranormal experiences. In the case of comfort blankets, their brains believe that while a parent is not available, a blanket or other object can have the same emotional traits, effectively becoming a replacement. Yes, that's called a transitional object, you idiots. Okay, let's move on. Oh, this one just cracked me up. Jesus sighting bolsters believers in Eastern Connecticut. This comes out of the Norwich Bulletin. You know, you have people who see Jesus in their grilled cheese sandwich and the Virgin Mary. Here on Galveston Island, there's a building on the bay side of the city. And on one side of this building, people say that you can see an image of the Virgin Mary on it. Now, I have gone and I have sat and I have looked and I can't see the image of the Virgin Mary. So I don't know what the deal is. Maybe my glasses need to be adjusted. Peter Dymas was sitting in the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church in Norwich several weeks ago when he looked up to the pale blue stuccoed ceiling and saw a familiar face staring back at him. Even though churches, especially Greek Orthodox, are known for the decor of religious images, churches are gorgeous. The face of Jesus Dymas saw was not one of the statues or pictures that adorn other parts of the church. The eyes, hair, nose, and mouth of Jesus are shaded, though church officials say unintentionally, into the domed ceiling repainted about 8 years ago. So this guy, you know, he was in a pretty spiritual place, and he was probably praying, and maybe he was a little distressed, and he looked up at the dome, and he saw Jesus. I'm not going to say whether or not he did. I don't want people to think I'm crazy, said Dymas, but who owns Sunset Pizza in Norwich and attends the church regularly? He pointed out the image with a red pen light, one of those little laser things, Friday afternoon, and asked, you can see it, right? Jesus Christ is believed by Christians to be the Son of God. His likeness has been seen by believers all over the world for centuries and identified in places ranging from the side of a tree in Quincy, Illinois, to a flour tortilla in Lake Arthur, New Mexico. After identifying the image, Dymas pulled the Reverend Paul aside after the service and pointed out the face to him. The Reverend said he can see it, though it took a few times searching the ceiling before he could pick it out. It looks like a face, the face of Jesus Christ, he said quite simply. Neither Dymas nor, I keep massacring this poor guy's name, nor the Reverend feel the image is a major religious miracle. But Zima said he wanted to share the site with others because it is special. It's a good thing to believe, said Stacy Bellis, who sits on the church board and also saw the face. Well, you got several people seeing this face. It's almost like a cloud from the heavens. Harvey Egan, a theology professor at Boston College, doesn't put much credence in the divinity of most religious sightings reported. He pointed out the Catholic Church has approved fewer than 10 locations over the last 200 years where it believes major visions have occurred. Such phenomena are a test that people will see in these things what they want. Okay, let me throw something out there for you guys. There have been times when I have been really, really distressed or really, really upset about something. You know, something's going on in my life. And so I have this beautiful beach that I can go sit on. And so I'll go sit on the beach, and what I'll do is I'll say a little prayer. I'll say a prayer to my deceased relatives, to my guardians, to my concept of a universal, all-encompassing being, and I will talk and talk about what's going on, and then I will say, give me a sign that I'm being heard. And all of a sudden, I'll see a couple of dolphins out there in the ocean, and I'll have a sense that I've been heard. And it's just a strong sense. And I've had lots and lots of patients share that with me, share with me that they've been very, very distressed, and they've asked for a sign, and they've had an experience or seen something that means something to them specifically. So who's to say? You know, I'm sitting here, I'm the Jew, I don't know if this guy saw Jesus or not. So this guy who he's obviously a big deal in the Catholic Church, goes on and says, such phenomena are a test that people will see in these things what they want. If people are religious and there's a certain cloud formation, they might see angels in that. If they are particularly artistic, they may see a sunset and say it reminds them of a Monet. Egan said true apparitions recorded in the past in locations such as Fatima in Portugal and Lourdes in France have caused transformations in people. He said these miracles were seen through the eyes of the soul rather than the limited vision of the human body. Don't you just love the way these guys put their own interpretation on somebody's personal experience? He didn't call the image in the church ceiling a miracle, but said it should serve as a reminder that Jesus and other religious icons are always around. Sometimes it's easy to get caught up in the paperwork and administration of the church and forget why we're here, said the Reverend. Just like people get caught up in the busyness of life, yes. This is them saying to us, we are here. And that was published September 2nd. So if you have an experience, if you're in a place of meditation or prayer and all of a sudden you have an experience that feels really, really real for you, a sense of connectedness to everything in the universe or a sense that everything is going to be okay, even though you feel like your life is in the center of a hurricane, that's what you need to take with you, regardless of what your clergy says, or your shrink, or your doctor, or your family. Your intuition is that is your spiritual point. That is your spiritual point. That's your sense of connectedness. And so don't give that over to anybody. Well, let's continue with the Catholic Church. I'm not, pounding on the church tonight, but I'm going to pound a little bit. Harry Potter, satanic Pope's Exorcist. Okay, this is from The Age Australia, September 1st, 2006. The Vatican has never been a fan of Harry Potter. No, they've never been a fan of Harry Potter because anytime you have a system, any type of system, any sort of alternative explanation for the unseen world that takes from clergy who see themselves in positions of power, what do you get? You get clergy who are losing power. So what are they going to want to do? They have to dismiss it. Why do they have to dismiss it? Because they don't want to lose power. It's really, really simple. For those of you who have issues with the Harry Potter books, pick one up and read it, for crying out loud. It's no worse than the Ray Bradbury stuff that I read as a kid, or some of that Stephen King. It's milder than Stephen King, but just pick it up. Alice in Wonderland, it's the same sort of phenomenon. It's just, you know, it's got a more modern-day twist. But, of course, you know, the Vatican is going to slam dunk the fictional boy wizard as downright evil. Behind Harry Potter hides the signature of the king of the darkness, the devil, said Father Gabriel Amorth, the Pope's caster out of demons. So this is the Pope's exorcist. The books contained many positive references to the satanic art, falsely drawing a distinction between black and white magic, he told the Daily Mail in London. The father also said he was convinced that Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler were possessed by the devil. Okay, how many of you watch the Hitler Channel? I watch the Hitler Channel. Adolf Hitler is a nut job. He was a nut job. Just ask my aunt who went to Auschwitz. Joseph Stalin was a nut job. Just ask some of my cousins who ended up in the gulags. Okay, both those guys were nuts. But possessed? No. Last year, the Pope and then Cardinal Ratzinger described Harry Potter as a potentially corrupting influence. The Vatican's criticism comes as two Australian academics suggest a new generation of spiritual seekers are using popular fiction and medieval myth to add magic and enchantment to their lives. Editors of a new collection of essays on popular spirituality said sacred religious texts and scriptures were in many places being superseded by medieval myths, comics, and fantasy literature. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my! Lions and tigers and bears, oh my! Oh, these people crack me up. Pagans had borrowed from the Discworld series, peopled by dwarfs, witches, and fairies, while young men had shaped their living fantasies on comic book heroes and Star Wars narratives. We're all going to hell in a handbasket. Take those Star Wars movies and you best get them out of your house. Role-playing games of the 1990s, such as Dungeons & Dragons. Remember all the hype about Dungeons & Dragons for those of us who all participated? We were definitely, I mean, we were taking the fast track to hell just for, you know, playing that game and acting out with fictional characters and events. Let me tell you something about these books. The thing about these books for children, like Harry Potter, when kids read these books and there are fights between dark and light, it gives them an opportunity to discharge some of the hard feelings they may be having about difficulties they're experiencing in their lives. They go to school, somebody makes fun of them, calls them fat, stupid, picks on them. They can pick up a book and all of a sudden they can have a sense of power. So as a bona fide therapist who's worked with lots and lots of kids, Harry Potter is not going to wreck your children. If anything, it's going to give them an outlet. Halloween is another outlet. It gives kids a chance to become somebody else and to put on a mask and to be powerful. Okay, so let's go on with this ridiculous article. The electric vampire subculture, bigger in the U.S. and splintering from the 70s goth movement, borrows more from Anne Rice's broody, immortal, and powerful figure of Lestat in The Vampire Chronicles than Bram Stoker's figure of old. Okay, I'm going to stop here again. With the teenagers that I have worked with, a lot of the kids who come from really dysfunctional families, they come from families where they have been sexually assaulted, where the parents are addicts, where there's violent physical abuse, and it's really hard to get them out of those homes. The law makes it very, very difficult because you have so many people who screamed abuse in the 80s, and so now what has happened is that you have groups today that say that abuse is not such a big deal. Well, it is a big deal. these little goth kids who would come into my office with the black fingernails and the bright red lips and the white, white skin. Do you know what that is? That expression is a way of turning all the feelings that they have been harboring internally with regard to their abuse and the trauma in their family systems outward. It's not an unhealthy thing. It really isn't. It's usually transitional until they do some of the work that they need to do and learn how to have their feelings in a healthy way. Kids who grow up in dysfunctional families don't have access to healthy feeling reality, and they don't have healthy feeling reality because they have cuckoo parents who can't have healthy feeling reality themselves. So, yes, once again, Hitler and Stalin were possessed by the devil, says the Vatican exorcist. Adolf Hitler and Russian leader Stalin were possessed by the devil. And this is coming from our friend, the chief exorcist at the Vatican. He said that he made these comments during an interview with Vatican Radio. He said, of course the devil exists, and he can not only possess a single person, but also groups and entire populations. I am convinced that the Nazis were all possessed. All you have to do is think about what Hitler and Stalin did. Almost certainly they were possessed by the devil. Okay, I'm going to tell you people, if you're out there saying, well, yeah, the devil did it, read your history. Read your history about what was going on in Germany before Hitler took over. Read your history about Russification of Russia that was going on before Stalin began his great purges. There is a reason as to why these horrific, tragic historical events took place, and it involved lots of people. These two, Stalin was a blaring alcoholic, and Hitler was a drug addict. You can tell by their behavior and their actions from the horrors they committed and the atrocities that were committed on their orders. That's why we need to defend society from demons. According to secret Vatican documents recently released, wartime pontiff Pope Pius XII attempted a long-distance exorcism of Hitler, which failed to have any effect. Well, you know what? If this particular pope would have stood up and made more of a stink about Nazism and Hitler and been more supportive of the Jews, trust me, that would have had a greater impact than a long-distance exorcism. It's very rare that praying and attempting to carry out an exorcism from distance works. Of course, you can pray for someone from a distance, but in this case, it would not have any effect. There's great research out there, by the way, for those of you who are unaware. Research on individuals who have been prayed for in hospitals and how their health has improved. There is bona fide, documented, statistically analyzed research on this. Go check it out. So maybe if the Pope had been praying for healing and while standing up and supporting the Jews and the gypsies and the homosexuals and the mentally retarded, oh boy. Let's see. One of the key requirements for an exorcism is to be present in front of the possessed person, and that person also has to be consenting and willing. Hey, Adolf, come here. We need to do an exorcism. Take a seat. Therefore, trying to carry out an exorcism on someone who is not present or consenting and willing would prove very difficult. However, I have no doubt that Hitler was possessed, and so it does not surprise me that Pope Pius tried a long-distance exorcism. In the past, this particular Vatican exorcist has also spoken out against the Harry Potter books, claiming that reading the novels of the teen wizard opened children's minds to dabbling with the occult and black magic. He is also president of the International Association of Exorcists, and he said that the books behind Harry Potter hides the signature of the King of Darkness, the devil. These sorts of books, what they do is they open children up to other possibilities. It, you know, when you say to a child, you need to just pray to God, that's sort of spooky. I'm supposed to pray to this concept that I can't see, I can't touch. You can't imagine how many kids have asked me questions like, so when I'm going to the potty, is God watching? What books like Harry Potter do is they give kids something concrete to pin this stuff on. But this exorcist said that Rowling's books contain innumerable positive references to magic, the satanic art, and added the book's attempt to make a false distinction between black and white magic, when in fact the distinction does not exist. Well, talk to a pagan. Pagans will tell you differently. Because magic is always a turn to the devil. Always a turn to the devil. He is said to have carried out more than 30,000 exorcisms in his career, and his favorite film is, according to Italian newspapers, The Exorcist. Now, people made some brilliant comments on this story, and I want to share them with you because I'm right with them. Somebody in the United States said, oh, great, another magical thinking explanation for murderous behavior. We in the reality-based world know that both Hitler and Stalin were psychopaths and murderous criminals. The next thing you know, the Catholic Church will be telling us that the Earth is the center of the solar system and evolution is fiction. And from Dallas, Texas, now I have heard everything. If that is the case, then nobody who commits a crime is guilty because the devil made me do it. And by the same token, nobody who works hard to achieve greatness is responsible for their achievements. Boy. So, we just heard how basically, once again, the church is saying that anybody who believes in the paranormal, magic, you know, seriously, if you think about it, I like to sit and I like to meditate. And when I meditate, when I get really, really quiet and I have a sense of my relatives around me, what I will say is, okay, I am stuck. I am so stuck. I have a problem. I need a solution. And within a matter of hours, all of a sudden, I'm enlightened and I have a solution. It works every single time. Before I see a patient, I always say a little prayer. I always ask for direction. And interestingly, every single time, it works. It works hand in hand with all that great education I have. But let me tell you, there are a lot of folks out there in my field who do a lot of damage and spread dis-ease because they don't take care of their own unfinished business. And because they are so down on any form of spirituality and they won't talk about it. We're spiritual beings, and so to neglect that part of ourselves is ridiculous. And to think that it's just hardwired into us is also ridiculous. And so what I want to do now is I want to talk to you a little bit about the God spot. Now, first of all, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the poo-pooing of the God spot. And this is from the BBC News. Doubt casts over brain God spot. There is no single God spot in the brain, Canadian scientists say. Okay, well, you just had the other researchers say that it's hardwired in our brain. Now, these folks are saying it's not in our brain. The University of Montreal team found Christian mystics' experiences are mediated by several brain regions. Researchers asked 15 nuns to recount mystical experiences while studying them on MRI scanners. There has been much debate about how the brain reacts during connections with God among religious followers. This does not diminish the meaning and value of such experiences, and neither does it confirm or disconfirm the existence of God, said the lead researcher. Now, I have to tell you, the reason why I wrote my second book, A Glimpse of Heaven, was because after I wrote the book, One Last Hug Before I Go, I had individuals who were emailing me and coming up to me and talking about the physical changes they had experienced after having a near-death experience or a deathbed vision or after having that universal experience of feeling connected to everything around them. They would talk about sensitivity to light. They would talk about feeling energized. There was this big list People who had what are called kundalini meditation experiences would also talk about this. The first time I had a kundalini experience, I had a lot of physical changes take place in my body, and they were consistent with those reported by others. And these experiences can also be tracked through history. So, you know, finally you have some researchers who are willing to actually take a look at this. Some people went as far as suggesting that there was a specific brain region designed for communication in the God, with God. We're going to talk about a friend of mine who actually has done some of that research. But the researchers claim the study discredits those theories. Well, I don't know about that. Nuns are said to experience a mystica, the Christian notion of a mystical union with God. So what they did is they looked at these nuns ages 23 to 64 and asked them to recount their experiences and measure, and then what they did is they measured brain activity using an MRI. Now, first of all, recounting the experience, there's going to be some triggering of emotion, definitely. But I have to tell you that it's not going to be the same as doing an MRI on somebody who is actually going through a mystical experience. So that is the first problem with this research. The main goal of the study was to identify the neural correlates of a mystical experience. Rather than there being one spot that relates to mystical experiences, we found a number of brain regions are involved. And then once again, they say this does not diminish the meaning and value of such experience, but neither does it confirm such experiences. These brain studies can give us fascinating insights into how the human body and mind and spirit interconnects. But they should not make us think that prayer and religious experience are just an activity in the brain. Okay, that's coming from a Catholic priest. True Christian mysticism, or any type of mysticism, in my opinion, is an encounter with the unseen. Now, according to Christians, it's an encounter with the living God, Jesus, and we meet him in the depths of our soul. So, anyway, it's an experience that goes far beyond the normal boundaries of human psychology and consciousness. You know, every time one of these little researchers decides that they're going to, like Susan Blackmore, you know, any of these psychops, nut jobs, decide that they're going to prove that we are wired for paranormal experiences, what happens is that their research, or lack of it, is always flawed. Every single time, it's flawed. So I'll hear about a new piece of research, and I'll think, okay, I got to take a look at this. Actually, I emailed my buddy, Dr. Bruce Grayson, and told him about some of this stuff, and sent some information to him so that he could take a look at it, because he is a hard-nosed researcher, so he'll root it out. But we have another friend. Bruce and I both have another friend, and his name is Dr. Melvin Morris, and he's an MD. And he has written numerous medical journals on near-death experiences in children, and is the author of New York Times bestsellers Closer to the Light, great book, great read, Transformed by the Light. And his latest book is titled Where God Lives. And this book sheds new light on the link between science and mysticism, and it reveals the area of the brain that is our biological link to the universe. So he's taken a whole different spin. For decades, for centuries, we have had the mystics who say it is a totally outside-the-body experience that we encounter when we have a mystical experience, and then we have the scientists who have said, no, 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 you people are all whacked. It is completely and totally a hardwiring deal. It's in the brain, it's in the body. Well, what Melvin did is he is taking the stance that no. It's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both, and we need to pay attention to that. So he did an interview on his book, Where God Lives, with the New Sun newspaper. And the title of this article is, because I'm going to just skim over it, is It Started by Listening to Children. Now, just real quickly, I'll give you a breakdown on him. What he started doing in his practice, he's a pediatric doc, and he works with children. So, of course, you work with children. You work with children who are really sick. You work with really, really sick children. You're going to work with children who are terminal, and you're also going to work with children who have near-death experiences. And he was a non-believer. And what he started doing is he really started listening to these kids when they would share with him these near-death experiences. And that's where Closer to the Light came and Transformed by the Light came. He shows up at some of the International Association for Near-Death Studies conferences. He actually has broken ground with the medical community. So, the interviewer says, in your new book, you talk about the right temporal lobe of the brain being the God spot. Could you elaborate? And Dr. Morris says, conventional neurologists, if you were sitting across from some neurologist from Einstein Medical Center, he or she is going to tell you that the right temporal lobe is for memory and the integration of memory with our emotions and our personality. Wilder Penfield, the father of neuroscience, like to call the right temporal lobe the interpretive cortex, meaning that memories are not stored there, but our ability to interpret memories are stored there. Okay, so do you understand that? Memories aren't stored there. That's kind of like our computer is there, and what happens is that our memories are sort of filtered through that, and that enables us to interpret our memories. Okay. It's also well known that the right temporal lobe is the source of spiritual visions. Dr. Carl Primbrom, who's a mainstream neurophilosopher, has always said that the kingdom of heaven is in our right temporal lobe. So the interviewer says, is there a way to activate the right temporal lobe without having a near-death experience? Prayer, meditation, the changing your life. Could do it. Is there any device or something that you can hook up to? And so Dr. Morris, he kind of laughs and he says, I was talking to a group of EEG technicians. These are people who measure the brain waves in our brains. And they asked me the same question. It just came into my head. I just said, well, maybe that's what prayer is. However, I have to give you a qualifying comment before I answer your question directly. So he's going to explain a few things. We don't know if spiritual visions, like for people that pray and see God, are the same as near-death experiences. We don't. There is very little research done on that issue. I'm not aware of really anyone who has looked at it. And he's right about that. Let's say 100 patients who've had near-death experiences are systematically compared to those who have spiritual experiences, which are spontaneous. Now, personally, from my perspective, I think that they're very similar experiences. I really, really do. The fascinating part about my research, he says, is that the large number of people who have beautiful, spontaneous spiritual experiences say it just happens to them for no particular reason. The second very fertile time for a spiritual experience, activation of the right temporal lobe, is in that dreamy, hypnagogic state. Now, you and I have talked about that. People describe very beautiful experiences during that period of time. Robert Louis Stevenson taught himself how to have hypnagogic experiences. What he would do was sit at the fireplace and hook himself up to this sort of harness. As he would fall asleep, this harness would jerk him awake. He would do this over and over again. Many of his novels were written in a hypnagogic trance. He felt that he sort of directly channeled many of his novels. That's very interesting. There's a guy named Michael Persinger up in Canada, and he directly stimulates the right temporal lobe to induce what he calls the God experience. He uses an electrical device. And then there was Wilder Penfield, who took stainless steel probes and probed the right temporal lobe, and patients would see God and have a variety of spiritual experiences. And then it's clear that drugs will induce the experience. I think there have been three main drugs that have been implicated, LSD, mescaline, and ketamine. All three of those act on the right temporal lobe. Now, I have to tell you that though this is true, there are some differences between having a sober near-death experience or departing vision and a drug-induced experience. There's a science of soul travel developed around how to have out-of-body experiences. Many Eastern religions are aimed at inducing the out-of-body and spiritual experience. Various meditative techniques can clearly induce this experience. In the Air Force, they do centrifuge studies in which they take these fighter pilots and whirl them around at tremendous speed until the blood flow in their brain stops, spatial disorientation. They go into a coma and they nearly die from the experience. Boy, talk about going to any lengths to have an experience. I think I'll just meditate. They have seizures and go into profound comas. And then, sure enough, they have this spiritual experience. Now, if you listen to these guys talk, their experiences are also a bit different from people who have classic, traditional, after-death communications, deathbed visions, near-death experiences, premonitions. So all the evidence lines up that these are right temporal lobe events. There are a lot of different techniques out there. Now, there was this guy gang named Robert Monroe of the Monroe Institute, Virginia Beach, if I'm correct, who did come up with a method for inducing out-of-body experiences. And he believed that certain musical frequencies could induce these experiences. So if you're interested in having a safe out-of-body experience, plug the name Robert Monroe into your search engine and pick up a few of his books. He was a real character. Going on with the interview. Nevertheless, having said all that, we still don't know if that's the near-death experience or not. We just don't. Now, see, Melvin isn't an experiencer. I have to tell you that. So what he tries to do is he tries to study these experiences. So if you talk to somebody who has had one of these encounters, what they will say to you is that, look, I don't care whether or not you want to believe me. I don't care whether or not you think I'm nuts. It was real for me. It happened. But people like Mel, we need people like Melvin to research these experiences. So now he's going to talk about children. Children, when they've had a near-death experience, which is really the dying experience, this is the last experience we'll all have when we're alive. They get a look in their eye. They go, wow. And then you'll say, what happened? And they'll say, I don't know. Now, children, near-death experiences are typically very, very pure. They're pure because most very young children haven't been totally indoctrinated with rigid societal institutions, clergy, church, and so their experiences are very spontaneous. And I love listening to children talk from, you know, coming from all different religious backgrounds, talk about near-death experiences. Whereas I've seen videotapes of Michael Persinger's research. This is the individual who's in Canada, who directly stimulates the right temporal lobe, still there is a difference. They're very matter of fact, and he is right about this. So you have these researchers. When Penfield, this one of the first neurologists around, took this probe and inserted it into the human brain, he didn't get the light and the tunnel and the emotions and the wonderment. What he got was a quick blip of something, a quick picture frame, and that's what these scientists get. And a lot of times when people are on drugs, they'll have some of these disjointed experiences which may have some of the aspects of a near-death experience or a deathbed vision, but it's not like those of a true experiencer. So basically, what the interviewer says is, so, these scientific probings are not a wow experience like a traditional near-death experience. And Melvin says, based on his gathering and collecting of children's experiences, yeah, I really think that once the research has been done and once we start to understand the experience better, this is now an intuitive leap on my own. Okay, so he's theorizing. we're going to see that there's a neurological machinery which allows us to have the experience. Okay, did you hear that? Got that? Categorize that? But then there's an endpoint that if you don't connect with, you don't have what you're calling the wow experience. So it's almost like we have a mechanism in our brain that can assist us in beginning to process the experience, but then the true experience goes beyond brain mechanisms. Okay? You just don't, he says, when you see people who have had this experience, when it occurs to them spontaneously, it's very different than the artificially induced experience. There is that wow aspect to it. So you have these people who want to beat down the doors and scream and yell and say, well, we can induce it. We can induce this with drugs, and we can, and the fighter pilots have these experiences, and we can induce this with probes. It's not the same thing. It's just the tip of the iceberg. So, have you had a spiritually transformation as a result of your work? This is the interviewer asking Melvin. I'm not particularly religious. I've had these experiences. I've had enough spiritual experiences that I now believe in God. And his experiences are truly a byproduct of the work that he's done with his patients. I'll give you an example of my own opinion. I was on a radio show and some atheist called up. He wanted to make the point very forcefully that there's nothing in my research that implies or proves that there's a God. My research can be explained without subscribing to a God. I couldn't argue because it's true. If you're going to define God as a male figure who is actively running the universe, there's nothing in my research or even in my personal experiences that indicates that that's true. So I'm going to tell you about my experience, but twist it around in such a way so that it's not religious at all, just for the sake of argument. I saw this young boy. He nearly drowned over here off a highway. The car went off the side of a road. His dad was driving and plunged into the river. Dad was killed instantaneously. Mother struggled and finally was able to save herself. Passerbys heroically saved the little boy. He explained to me that he was in a huge noodle. This is one of my favorite Melvin Morris kid NDE experiences. So listen closely, gang. And then he says, well, it just must have been a tunnel because I don't think noodles have rainbows in them. Then he says, was it real? If it was real, then you have to tell all the old people, meaning this is what's going to happen when we all die. We're going to have this experience. There are at least two levels of reality. I meet with these theoretical physicists about four times a year out in Las Vegas, and these are all the top guys from Los Alamos. What they've explained to me is that there is the reality that we perceive right now. This is what we would call local reality. And then there's what's called non-local reality, which is timeless and spaceless. So these are theoretical physicists who are stating this. I always call it a timeless, spaceless place. He's talking about the near-death experience. That shows how foolish we are, how grounded we are in local reality, because we can't even describe non-local reality. Obviously, it can't be a place, but it's timeless and spaceless. This has been the hardest thing for me to grasp. This is the hardest concept that I've had personally. This concept that there is a non-local reality is well accepted by the scientific community, so why am I telling you all of this in the context of my own spiritual beliefs? I tell you why. You started out by asking me, what's this right temporal lobe for? I had been kind of wondering that, too. So I was in Salt Lake City on a promotional trip, and this Mormon is taking me all around. All my interviews were canceled that day because of snowstorm, so we were just basically talking. She looks at me and she says, "So you've never prayed?" I said, "No, I was raised Jewish, and to me, prayer, I don't know. I would never pray. I mean, if your child is in the hospital, suddenly you start to pray. I've had fearful experiences where I've said, oh, if there's a God, but I'd never really prayed." She said, "Okay, if you've never prayed, and yet you believe in the right temporal lobe, and you believe this right temporal lobe is the connection to God, why haven't you prayed?" I said, "I don't know. I got other things to do." She says to me, "You should pray." So I said, "Okay, I will. How do you pray?" She said, "When I was a little girl, I was taught to kneel at the foot of my bed and thank God for everything that's happened in my life that's good. I agreed to give this a try. I was at the Marriott there, and I knelt at the foot of the bed. I felt so stupid. I thought about my wife and my kids and my practice, all that stuff, and then I asked God a single question. I want to understand the relationship between man and God. I want to know if my theories are true. Is there truly a link between man and God, or are we just kidding ourselves? Is this some sort of self-generated right temporal lobe fireworks to give us the illusion that there is a God because for some reason we as human beings need to have a God?" That was my question. And then I said I wanted to know the answer in 24 hours. Remember I talked to you about, you know, putting a prayer out there to the universe and within a few hours you're going to get your answer? Well, Melvin got his answer. Because I thought it's such a vague question that how would I know, it's got to be something very clean, very, very clean, and I wanted it within 24 hours. That whole process took less than 10 minutes. I flew to L.A. for a whole day with interviews, and I had forgotten this whole thing. Then in my hotel room in L.A., I was standing by the desk, and suddenly that's when it happened to me. I was surrounded completely all over my body by this bubble of light. It was like being in a kind of warm, sticky, wonderful. I felt like I was being bathed in honey or something so wonderful. And as soon as it happened, I knew it was that these kids, what these kids had been telling me about, the kids who had the near-death experiences. It was wonderful, and it was clearly timeless. It felt like never ended. In fact, it only ended when I thought to myself, I wonder if this is going to end. This was the first intrusion of a verbal thought. I'm a very verbal person, so nonverbal things just don't happen to me that often. He had a spiritual experience, gang. He had a bona fide spiritual experience. Here's my point, he says. There's no doubt in my mind that I had this experience. See? See how things change? He had an experience, no doubt in his mind. It was not a false experience at all. What happened to me was the direct communication with the universe. I instantly knew the answer to my question. The answer came to me in a way that I could understand. I instantly understood the branch of mathematics called chaos mathematics. It's like I had all the knowledge. In an instant, I understood that we're what they call fractals. Like a snowflake is a fractal. If you take a piece of the snowflake, it has the same pattern as the whole. And then if you take a piece of the piece, you still see the same pattern. Fractals are all around us. Human heart is a fractal. The way our human heart beats, the pattern of the heart, our coastlines are fractals. Fractals are found in nature. The use of chaos mathematics is to understand things like jet turbulence. The first thing they studied in terms of understanding chaos mathematics was the dripping of a faucet. So even the dripping of a faucet is not random. There's a pattern. There's a pattern embedded within it. If you look at it for an hour, 24 hours, or a year, you're going to see a pattern. So what he's talking about is he's talking about the patterns in life. You can be an atheist and believe in that. There is nothing in my experience that indicates to me that there's a conscious God that is male and is ruling the universe. I'm so happy, Melvin. I'm convinced that everyone has the experience that I've had, but that each one interprets it according to their own understanding. Christians in a Christian format, Jews in a Judaic format, Muslims in a Muslimic format, Baha'i, you know, Buddhists. I think that's where all the misunderstanding happens. Like my wife sees pictures. I don't see pictures. I hear words. So if this experience comes to different people in different forms, some hear words, some are going to see an angel, some are going to see what they think is God, etc. But we're all basically talking about the same thing. We're talking about the same saying. So whether an atheist wants to say that the right temporal lobe allows us to communicate with a replicating pattern of energy that the theoretical physicist calls non-local reality, or whether someone a little simpler is going to say, wow, Jesus had me sit on his lap and told me there's a light that will tell me what I'm to do and where I'm to go. To me, there's no difference between those two statements. We have this biological equipment to communicate with something, some pattern of energy that incorporates all of us and all of what we call reality. To me, it is not controversial. That's a lot of the reason why I wrote the book. I want people to understand that these are not spiritual concepts I'm talking about. I'm not talking about some sort of spiritual new age or any age touchy-feely stuff. I'm talking about that 25% of our brain that is dedicated to allowing us to communicate with some pattern of energy that is always with us, that always will be with us and always has been with us. Just as our left side of our brain allows me to talk to you, the right side of our brain allows us to communicate with whatever this is. Forget about whether it's God or serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter in the brain. This is where my Jewish training helps me, because I was always taught that we can't name God. Jews don't name God. We don't. So maybe those are just different names for God. But regardless of that, you've got something in your brain right now which gives you a lot of valuable information. So, gang, what is the gist of this? Why did I want to share this with you? Because right now we have a lot of Muslim extremists who are out there preaching how they're first going to come after the Jews, then they're going to come after the Christians, and then they're going to come after those Muslims who don't believe the way they do, all in the name of God, their concept of God. Only their concept is right. And so what do we have going on in the United States of America? In the United States of America, we have Christians against Jews, Jews against Muslims, Muslims against Christians. You have people in little corners talking, pointing the finger of blame. And I think that if we all could come together and just sit down and really take a look at our individual concepts of whatever that supreme universal force is out there, what we're going to see is that we may all take different paths, but eventually we all come to the same place. And if that is true, that place is not a place of hate, and it's not a place of destruction. And if we can all band together and take care of each other and stand as one, we don't have to live in fear every time Al Jazeera puts out a new terrorist tape. So, whether you call your concept of a higher spiritual being, a higher power, or God, or Buddha, or Muhammad, or Yahweh, or if you want to call it Insof because it's not definable from the Kabbalist tradition, whatever you call that higher force, know that that higher force is no different for you than it is for the person who has a belief system that may be a little bit different from yours. This is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon. You have just taken a walk to the other side. If you have comments about tonight's show, or if you would like to share some of your feelings about tonight's show, go ahead and post them on the TNT message board for BBS radio website, or you can email me directly at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net. Or what you can do is you can plug Deathbed Visions into your search engine and you will find yourself at my webpage. On that webpage, I have books that discuss sexual addiction, relationships, food addictions, natural remedies for emotional distress, difficulties, establishing healthy boundaries and raising your children, deathbed visions, spiritual experiences, and I have a series of essays on that website which are there for you to take and read and enjoy. So so. Do so. Deathbed Visions, plug that into your search engine. Take a trip on over to my website. Take what you like. Leave the rest. This is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon. Thank you for taking a walk to the other side with me. Sleep deep, sleep sweet, and I will be talking with you in 2 weeks. Good night.